Traditionally, in the Theravada tradition, when they teach the spiritual discipline or spiritual life that's taught in Theravada Buddhism, they inevitably, invariably almost start with talking about not meditation, but the kind of things which are considered to be preliminary to a life of meditation or to a spiritual practice. Or preliminary, if you use the word preliminary, then people think, well, it's preliminary, it's not so important, it's not that we want the highest, the best. Maybe it's the entrance way, maybe it's the heart, maybe it's the most important thing to teach, that's why it's taught first. But what's taught first is the ethics, and specifically, first generosity, the practice of generosity. And after the practice of generosity, they talk about the practice of the precepts of living an ethical life. And here in the West, we usually do things upside down. Because Westerners are, it's less and less as the years go by, as we become more of a conservative society maybe or whatever. It used to be that the Westerners, the last thing they wanted to hear when they got involved with Buddhism was about precepts and ethics. They wanted the highest, supreme, best, you know, they wanted enlightenment to bust. So just, you know, so give me the meditation practice, that's where it's at, right? And don't, you know, don't give me any of the fluff. But now that Buddhism has been established in this country for many years and decades now, what's happening is that a lot of practitioners are realizing, hey, wait a minute, it's a natural expression and support of a meditation life is to live a life which is basically sane and ethical. And so now there's much more interest in ethics and teaching ethics right on, early on. But when I do a five-week introductory course on mindfulness meditation, if I did a five-week introductory course on precepts, how many people would show up? But if I do, what? More than I think. So we usually do an introductory course on meditation, that's what people want. And then eventually we, you know, tell them the punchline is that it doesn't really make sense to live a life that has a meditative base to it unless you're living an ethical life. Life is basically good. Because, you know, if you go out and rob the local bank, before you come to sit here, your sitting is not going to be very settled. You'll be worried, guilty, and you know all these things might happen. And so you can see after a while, very intimately and also very subtly, the relationship between the open-heartedness, the presence, the willingness to be present in a full and generous way, and living a life which is ethical. And you see the mutual relationship between the two of those. So that's kind of like, I don't know if it's a punchline, but it's a very important conclusion from a life of meditation. So I don't say much about that during the introductory course. So what I like to do is to say a little bit about it the week before that I'm, you know, at least that, you know, I won't be here next week, so it'll be today. And so you can think of it as being the first class, you know, and Terry's class is the second class, and then in 2 weeks is the third class of the introductory series. But you can think of it that way if you like. Or you can think of it being, we've done a whole cycle now, because I did the introductory course in last fall, and then we had a whole bunch of teachings and stuff after that. And this is the final culmination of the cycle, the pinnacle of Buddhist wisdom, is it, before we start the cycle over again in 2 weeks, or next week. So whatever way you want to see it. So I'd like to talk a little bit about precepts and the importance of precepts. And what I thought of doing a little bit today is just talk not some, about one of them in particular, and that's right speech, or the precept is actually not to tell lies, or to speak, or the precept to speak the truth. Because for many of us, that's probably the most difficult precept to keep, and it's the one that's probably has the most pervasive application in our normal life. Because most of us are speaking quite a bit, but you know, doing things like robbing banks, this doesn't happen, you know, as frequently. So there's different ways of understanding precepts in Buddhism, and one is that they're precepts of restraint, that they're restraining yourself in a certain way, and. And if you follow a precept of restraint, it could be useful, but usually you just do it out of the authority of the tradition or the authority of your teachers, or it's kind of like holding yourself back, rearing your kind of holding the reins back to prevent yourself from making a big mistake. And it's useful to do that. I kind of encourage people not to make mistakes and to kind of hold themselves back a little bit. But if it's just out of a sense of restraint, the motivations, the tendencies that lead to unethical behavior can just be bottled up and can actually get stronger and stronger. And it can lead to kind of hypocrisy or all kinds of problems or unhealthy attitude towards oneself in life. And it lends itself to a certain kind of puritanical tendencies. And as soon as you have, and if you're holding yourself back and restraining yourself kind of forcefully, then tendencies tend to become judgmental. And other people should do that, or why aren't they doing it? And it has some inherent problems, that approach. Another approach to precepts is that they arise out of compassion, that we have a sense of connectedness to ourselves and to others. And if you feel you have a sense of the pain it's going to cause someone if they learn that you've lied, then out of compassion for that person, not wanting to hurt them, perhaps you would be motivated not to lie. So that comes in coming from different motivation than just restraining yourself because you've been told that's a good idea and you're supposed to live an ethical life. So it's beginning to approach the precepts from some sense of understanding of consequence. So compassion can be, and connectedness can be, a source of motivation for living a life of the precepts. The third way of approaching the precepts is that the precepts are not prescriptions about how you should live your life, but rather the descriptions of what an awakened, compassionate life would be like. And so it's said somewhat, maybe sometimes, that the precepts are the expression of our innate nature, our fundamental nature. Our fundamental nature is one of connectedness, of openness, of not being greedy, not hating, living a life of delusion or confusion. And so someone who's awakened or living a life of awakening would naturally not break the precepts. And so the precepts then are a description of how an awakened person would live their life. And the way that, so some of you might not feel that you're particularly awakened. I don't know how you are. But the way it relates to us is that the precepts that are not rules so much of right or wrong, but rather they're guidelines, they're cues for how, pointing out to us when we've left perhaps our fundamental good nature, our true nature, our Buddha nature, whatever. So we if you notice that you're about to lie to someone, you say, hey, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be living by these precepts. The precept, maybe what this means, I'm about to cross that, violate that precept. Maybe what that means is that I'm really violating my own sense of deep integrity. So maybe I should pay attention here. Maybe I should look more carefully what I'm about to do. So the precepts then don't become this moralistic thing, but rather become this pointer, this suggestion. You should look more carefully at this particular event. If you're about to kill a mosquito or to kill some insect, what's the motivation behind that? Why do you want to do that? The precept says don't kill. Why do you want to, and perhaps if the precepts are a description of awakening, of our true nature, then stop and look, well, why am I wanting to do that? Is this really what I want to do? And then maybe it isn't, or maybe it is. And you can do that with each of the precepts. Not harming others, not taking what is not given, not lying, not abusing sexuality, and not indulging in intoxicants are the five precepts. So there's three different ways of looking at these things. And for many Westerners, particularly the last two are the ones that kind of inspire them the most, out of compassion or out of sense that it's our own nature, that we don't want to violate ourselves. It isn't so much we don't want to violate social norms. And we want to be very careful with precepts because we have such a strong tendency, many of us, of judging ourselves negatively, being hypercritical. And so the precepts become one more great example of a place you can kind of be self-critical and say, well, I blew that one, or, boy, I'm pretty lousy. But Buddhism looks at precepts, at ethical life, not in terms so much of blame and guilt, but as something to learn from. So there might be some feeling you feel kind of bad that you did something, you lied to your best friend, but rather than kind of feeling guilty then and hating yourself for it, you say, well, I feel bad about it, I feel some remorse, and then how can I do better in the future? What can I learn from this? So the ethics of Buddhism tends to be forward-looking rather than backwards-looking. And backwards-looking, I would say, is kind of feeling forever some kind of guilt and shame and whatever. And forward-looking means you kind of see how you can, what you can learn from this and how you can do better in the future. So the idea of guilt or blame is not so important in Buddhism as it is sometimes in Christianity. And so there's a wonderful Zen story of talking about turtles. We talked about turtles earlier today. Of this Zen cook who made turtle soup. And it was served in the Zen monasteries. They eat in the meditation hall. It's very formal, and all the monks are sitting around the edge of the hall and facing each other and eating in a very formal way. And the cook was called into the meditation hall after the soup had been served. And the abbot pointed to his bowl. And floating on the surface of the soup was a turtle head of a turtle, which isn't supposed to be there. So he pointed to it, and the cook came in, just abbot pointed, nothing was said, and the cook reached in and picked up the head and plopped it in his mouth, ate it, and walked out. And that in Zen is called eating the blame. You know, he wasn't defensive, or he didn't justify it, or explain it, or blame it on one of the assistant cooks, or he didn't apologize even. He just saw there was a case, saw it, admitted it, kind of acknowledged the situation, and took care of it. Eating the blame. So I thought that taking responsibility without any of the extra stuff we tend to add to it. And I think it's a beautiful story, taking responsibility without all the extra stuff. I mean, how many times have I been around someone, maybe I've done it enough times myself, where I've done something wrong or someone's done something wrong, and they're so apologetic, it just drives me crazy. You know, okay, you know. Just take responsibility and be quiet. Another way of looking also at precepts is that there are guidelines for what connects us to others and what separates us from others. And a Buddhist life is a life that is one of connectedness, of understanding the inherent connectedness and developing connectedness among people and the world and nature and plants and animals and everything. So what brings more connectedness, which is what a lot of people want anyway? One way of understanding this is the precepts bring connectedness, and violating the precepts creates separation. You know, if I rob that bank and they catch me, boy, am I going to be separated. But, you know, if you lie to someone, there's a rupture that's happened there. Or if you abuse someone sexually, you know, take it whatever ways, abuse your sexuality, there tends to be a kind of creative separation of anger or distance or whatever. So all the precepts, that's true. So they're guidelines, you know, how can we be more connected and how can I prevent unhealthy separation? So the Buddha gave four criteria for how to speak. I guess these criteria is when you should speak. There's a tendency in Buddhism to feel like, you know, you don't need to speak too much. You can speak, you know, just, you know, be just content just being. You don't have to always be speaking. We all know, I mean, how much neurotic speech goes on in our culture. You know, unnecessary speech. People are uncomfortable with silence. And they can't sit together and be quiet. Because you always have to fill the space with stuff and make things happen. And you go to, you know, cocktail party, if people still do that. You know, all the kind of the superficial conversation that's one-upmanship and, you know, whatever, all these things that happen. So the Buddha is said to give four criteria for when to speak. And he said you should speak when it's, and you don't have to take this too literally, it's just the only time you should speak, you should have a good time too. But it's just a nice thing to have in the back of your mind, kind of sometimes to evaluate yourself, to look at yourself, to understand yourself better. One is what you're going to say truthful? And that's pretty basic. You know, is it honest what you're about to say, or are you going to lie? Is it false? And you should only say what is truth, what is truthful. The second is it kind to say it? And we all know that it's possible to use truth as a weapon. And, you know, you really got someone's number, and you're going to grill them with the truth, you know, and really make them hurt. That's not kind. So is it also kind, what you're about to say? The third is it useful, what you're about to say? It might be truthful, and it might be kind, but the person just simply might not hear it or care or just might not have any use. And that happens sometimes. Someone's completely oblivious to anything you might say. And it might be important to try. It's frustrating, it's certainly dangerous to kind of hold yourself back. But why waste your breath? If you really feel it's useless to say anything, maybe you're better doing something else, or approaching the whole situation in a different way. So the Buddha said, is it useful to speak this way? And the fourth is, does it promote harmony? Does it promote connectedness and allow people to be more connected with each other? And if we use these four criteria for our speech, well, many of us would stop speaking. but I think it's something to be taken, to be considered at least, to think about these things and to see, you know, to take one of them maybe different days of the week and see, well, do I usually speak truthfully? Do I usually speak kindly? Or is this kind? Or is this useful? Or is this whatever? And the most extreme form of this, which seems a bit extreme to me, is some Buddhist monks who believe the only thing which is really you should talk about is Dharma or Buddhist practice itself. And there, you know, they'll talk about it with passion, but you ask about anything else and just, oh, nothing happens. And that seems a bit extreme to me. So truthfulness, not lying. The Buddha has said, words are not well spoken unless they can contain truth. And it said that it says that the precept of not lying is the most common precept which is broken by people. And it takes many forms. It's exaggeration, it's lies of omission, it can be silence. It can be kind of a lie sometimes. But exaggeration, is exaggeration truthful? If you say, you know, I saw the very best movie ever last night, or, you should go to that restaurant, it was the best restaurant, you know. Is it the best restaurant? What are you actually saying when you say it's the best this or the most wonderful that? What is the point you're trying to make? It's not really true that it's the best this and that, but rather perhaps it's a kind of way of saying, you know, I'm special because I did that. Or, I don't know, we all do it sometime or other. It's a way of building ourselves up. It's a way of creating a nice environment and kind of getting it charged a little bit. It's a way of creating a charged connection with someone because there's energy there when you say, you know, the most and the best and this and that. And what is behind lying? You know, if lying is considered to be a violation of our integrity, a violation of our deep sense of self, what function does lying have? What function does it serve? And if you look underneath lying, you'll find such things as ambition, greed, fear, embarrassment. And lying is motivated by certain intentions. And what are those intentions? And just to notice you're about to lie and then stop and take a step back and say, why am I doing this? What am I trying to get from this situation? I think it's a very important thing for mindfulness students to do. In Zen, in our tradition, we have 5 precepts for lay people. In Zen, they have 10 precepts for lay people. And a number of the extra ones have to do with speech. And one of them is don't praise self at the expense of others. I think it's a beautiful one. Don't praise yourself at the expense of others. It doesn't say don't praise yourself. It's considered fine to praise yourself, your good qualities and deeds. But don't do it as a way of at the expense of others, of putting other people down or lifting yourself above other people so that other people are kind of below you or whatever. Can you use your speech, the way you talk about yourself, to maintain an honest and open connectedness with people and not create status or difference or hostility, not to create separation. So is it kind when we speak? When we speak, and what is it to be? What is kindness in speech or in communication or being present for someone? And I think just simply being present, being really present for someone, and listening, being able to listen to someone, is the foundation for kind speaking. If you don't really listen for someone, don't really know them, and don't know what's going on, it can lend itself to things which are not kind, even sometimes when they're meant to be kind. I was distressed once when I was at work. I was working as a cook at a restaurant, and I was at a changing room where you go into your cook's clothes, and I was getting dressed to go to work in this little room. And someone else came on for the same shift. And as soon as he showed up, I did this light joking with him. It was pretty innocent, I guess, but it was came out of some kind of sense of friendship, perhaps. But I was kind of bantering with him, kind of jiving with him as soon as he came in. But what I hadn't done was taking the time to be present for him and listen to where he was at and where he was. As soon as he came in, I started my little silly little jokes. It turned out his best friend had just died. You know, I felt lousy. I should at least give myself a moment to listen, some space, rather than jumping in with what I had to say and what I wanted to do. So sometimes it takes a little bit of listening or presence or spaciousness to even know what the kind thing is in different situations. And then, is it useful or beneficial? And the Buddha said, don't bother rebuking someone who is incorrigible. And the energy of unnecessary speech can be, this is not true just for this, but any kind of unnecessary speech, there's energy there behind that. And one of the issues there is that there's energy, there's effort that is being used while you speak. And is there a more interesting ways to use that energy, that presence, that awareness, that attention that you have? And there are times when that energy, that time, that presence is better used in different kinds of ways. Sometimes just simply looking at someone, acknowledging them, or listening, or sitting together in silence, or many things. When I did my first long Vipassana retreat in Thailand, some of my deep appreciation and sense that, this is really a great practice, arose in relationship to the precepts. And I remember one of them was, before I did that retreat, I had a lot of strong sexual desires or lust for this woman. And I was planning, how I'd go back and see her at the end of the retreat and what we'd do and whatever. And at some point in the middle of the retreat, I realized that my appreciation of this woman was still there, but the lusting and sexual fantasies had all just kind of settled away. And I felt so much more healthier relationship to her than I had before. And somehow I felt it came from the subtleness and intimacy that came with the retreat itself. Like, this is who I really am. This is who I really want to be. This is who I am in my core. And everything else, all the lust, was kind of the surface chatter of my, hormones and thoughts and whatever. But then one was in relationship to speaking. I remember once, I hardly spoke at all during this 10-week retreat, but somewhere near them, two-thirds of the way through or so, I had to speak to this woman, and I was struck while I was speaking to her afterwards, that my speech was kind and truthful, and I had a kind of kind feeling to it, and it was like a completely new experience for me. And I thought, what was that about? Where did that come from? Because I hadn't spoken for days to anyone, and I thought, this is really interesting. This is arising out of some sense of deep intimacy or presence or subtleness or contentness with myself. What an interesting way to speak. And And I go, oh, this practice is really powerful. I think of honesty as being mindfulness practice out loud. The mindfulness practice is to acknowledge what's actually happening. And if you do that out loud, then you're honest. So I see speech and right speech and honesty as being really the logical extension of the basic mindfulness practice that we're doing here. And the more honest we are, the less regrets we have. And the less regrets we have, the easier it is to meditate and be intimate with oneself. And the more honest we are, the more I think we're in touch with something which is precious within us. And again, the easier it is to be willing to be intimate with ourselves, to be at home with ourselves. So now, does anyone dare speak? Questions, comments? Well, you probably need to give examples. I can think of situations where being honest with someone will hurt them, but it could be very useful, and it could be kinder and compassionate in the bigger picture. If you need to tell someone something which is painful about themselves, but it has a usefulness that actually they can learn something about it from that, and maybe change their ways, they might actually thank you later. And say, you know, that was painful to hear, but it was really compassionate or kind or useful or that you said that. So it depends on the example, rather than abstract. But I can see that it's useful.
I think you'd have to watch your intention very carefully in a situation like that.
Yeah, and that's a good point. With anything in Buddhism, but especially with speech, one of the ways to discern what is right speech is to look at the intention. And so, like I said earlier, you can be truthful and use it as a barb. But the intention then is to hurt someone. But if the intention is to help someone, then sometimes maybe, you know, you can go ahead and do it. So the underlying intent, taking a step back and seeing the underlying motivations for what we're doing is very important for discerning what's going on and what's appropriate. Do you have a particular example that you...
Not really, I just found myself in that predicament at times.
Yeah, I think we all have.
No, I think society in general approves of the so-called white lie.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what I was trying to address.
Yeah, I still do. I do white lies, I must admit. And I wonder, why do I do it? But it just seems like the alternative is... So, it seems so innocent. You know, it's like such a small little thing, you know, just barely, you know, it's like nothing. You know, this, but and then the person isn't hurt. So I must admit that I still do that to sometimes, but maybe it's not good.
Doesn't it come perhaps from a sense that, or a thought that you feel the other person won't be able to take the truth?
It could come
Here's
from
an example. Is, you know, if you're having dinner at someone's house and they ask, you know, how did you like the food? What if you didn't like it? It's not a graceful way to.
Well, how did you like it?
Yeah, it's. I mean, there are these dilemmas that arise. Yes.
There is a proverb that says a lie is not a lie when the truth is not expected.
Oh, so in a question like that, the truth is not being expected. They're not asking for the truth. That's why you have to listen carefully to what they're asking. They're not asking for the truth.
With their intention.
So that's an interesting. That's interesting.
People don't usually ask you.
Sorry?
Yeah, but where it comes, I mean, don't you get presents that you don't like? And don't you always say, oh, it's wonderful. You know, I mean, people,
but it is one. It is. But you want to
have to react in some way when you get it.
But you have to also kind of maybe you can also see what you should react to. You can kind of word it properly. So when you get a present from someone and you don't particularly like the present, you can say, "Oh, how wonderful!" And then maybe under your breath you say, "The intention of giving me a present." You know, so, you know, or how thoughtful, how really thoughtful of you. Yes.
Somehow when you started speaking about this, I started wondering whether there wasn't a category of speech in which things were neither true nor untrue. I mean, a lot of things you really have to look with a microscope to discover where truth lies.
So give me an example. Something.
Well, I think that what you're just talking about is a good example. I mean, it's so inconsequential whether one enjoyed the feeling of the gift or the gift itself or whatever. It's not really, I mean, it's another example, I think, of looking to hurt oneself,
yeah,
to examine so closely.
Yes, I think that's a good point. Because because many times what's being communicated is not the content. And we have to notice when the content is not really what people care about at all. So, for example, the most common example is, how are you? People don't want to start you going through your litany. You know, it's what that statement is they're meeting you. They're saying, they're acknowledging you're there, and kind of, you know, and so what you're supposed to say is, fine. How are you? Fine. And then, oh, by the way, you know, it's then you can kind of go into it eventually. But they're not asking for the truth. They're asking to be met. And I think everybody knows that intuitively, don't they? I mean, you know, every once in a while someone doesn't, and oh my. So I think that's a good point. Thank you.
But when you're in that very social situation where that kind of white lie stuff does come up, giving and receiving of gifts, and it is not a one-on-one situation, it does seem like when people really overdo the exaggerated white lie bit, that it makes it all very superficial and not very real and not very honest and not very good, really. And that it would be better if we could skillfully, perhaps, but tone it down so that it was more real. Mm-hmm. It would make the event better in many ways. You don't have to say, well, I don't really like that, yeah, but you can. But the effusiveness of many people,
yeah,
is.
Yeah, sometimes it can be too superficial.
It's very superficial.
And actually, so one of the again, I think one of the great questions is this help me connect with someone or be more separate? So I can imagine a little white lie could actually help create. I mean, they're kind of connecting to you. They've done something that creates connection. And so you want to acknowledge that and so kind of join that the best you can. But if you're lying too much and you're kind of going on and on about how wonderful and you've been wanting this for years and this and that and all this, you know, and it could create separation. And I think that's what you're pointing to, is mm-hmm, it can be done too much, it can be overdone.
I think most content in human interaction is not the content. There's a deeper layer that's harder to pay attention to. I mean, just like with my husband.
Yeah.
Our biggest arguments have been over, like, the dog or, you know, yard waste, things where the content is almost meaningless as to what we're really arguing about or what you're trying to convey to somebody. seems really common that rarely, or at least in our society, but say it's
So if you listen more carefully to what's really being communicated, sometimes you can find a different response than a white lie. You know, because you can kind of address what people want, for example, is friendship, is contact. Then maybe you can find some way before you don't have to say, you don't say thank you for the gift. You don't say, oh, this is a great gift. You go over and give them a hug. And you don't say anything, but you say, oh, that was really thoughtful, and give them a big hug. And that's really creating the connectedness. So I think it's really important to be able to listen to what else is being asked or being talked about below the content.
Can you repeat the four criteria for when you speak? Because it seems to me that most of the dilemmas people are bringing up fit in. At least I've been looking at it, if you look at it, the hierarchy. And I don't know if you meant it that way, but first you look at it, if it's true, okay, it's true, but then is it kind? So it may be true that the dinner was lousy, but would it be kind to say that? Okay, well, maybe it would be kind to say it was great, but would it be useful? Comment the same thing with business. Same thing with business, because I was in a job interview yesterday, and the woman said, well, I'm looking for 2-year commitment, and I was hesitant, and I was honest to say, well, I really don't know, and that was the end of that, So I'm like, well, should I? Maybe it was one of those situations where the truth wasn't expected, but what was it? I was wondering, one, if that is, if you meant it as a hierarchy, and two, what was the fourth one?
I didn't mean it as a hierarchy. It could be seen that way, I guess. But, and the fourth is, does it promote social harmony, concord? And so that's also good. So I think this is very good, I think. So that is it truthful? So, and is it kind? So, no, it was a lousy dinner. It wasn't really a kind thing to say. But to say, oh, thank you, I really appreciate it. You went to the effort to feed me. That's a kind and a truthful statement.
Well, on the other hand, if it was useful, if there are, lousy cook, and this is the 10th time, it may be useful to say it. I mean, the kindness
yeah, yeah.
Is given in the life.
Yeah, exactly.
Your next gift could be a
cookbook. Yeah. So speech is difficult, huh? And what about just so you're bringing up all the kind of easy gray areas in a sense. What about just old-fashioned lying?
Really think about the idea of the gift as a Christmas gift, and it was like, what is this? And I didn't know I would be confronted by my brother-in-law, but he called up and it was hard to give a hug because he's in Portland, but it's like, how do you like the gift? Oh, well, I was totally caught off guard, but I was trying, when I got it, I thought, well, I probably should say something when I do talk to them, but I was totally off guard when he did call, and it was like, about the gift. And so, the white lie, I had thought about lying, but I couldn't bring myself to do it when he called. And just said, oh, it's interesting. I mean, but he could tell, I know, because it just kept going on and on and on, how a person had made it, and his wife wears it, and she gets all these compliments and everything, and how, I could probably get the same reaction as he her.
Sometimes it depends how close you are with the person. If you're close enough, sometimes it's okay to say that.
Yeah.
You say, oh. But it depends. What's ruptured, I guess. Yes?
I think outright lies show up pretty often in the form of excuses. Excuses for not going places or meeting with people. There's fabricated
narrative. And why do we need to do that?
In my case, when I do it, I think I don't want to hurt the other person. If I were truthful to say, I don't want to be with you, or I'm tired, disappointment.
So you're trying to be kind.
Yeah. Or save face.
Yes.
It seems as though, except for the first one, I mean, truthfully, you have to make a lot of assumptions, which may or may not be correct, about whether something's kind and is or it's harmony.
And those assumptions are cultural, too. They may not be the same assumptions that the other person is making.
Yeah.
Because it's also variables.
There are also lots of what?
Variables.
Yes.
So often it doesn't matter what you say, it's where you're coming from when you say it. People think they're really stupid things, but if they're trying to be kind and that shines through, it almost doesn't matter.
When, this is not literally speaking, but in Japan, if you really like the noodles they serve, you're supposed to slurp them. And in America, slurping your food is not considered polite. So when I eat in Japan and they serve noodles, I would explain to the family that before I started eating, I said, you know, I really love noodles, but I don't really like to slurp. So they would know that, you know, there's a different cultural system and not to be offended by my crude way of eating noodles. But still, even though there's a lot of variables involved, I think, and maybe sometimes assumptions involved, but I think that we can be we can tune ourselves to various degrees to know what's kind and try to be kind. And a lot of it has to do with intention again, as you said.
Yeah, it seems to me that I know when I'm trying to do any of those things. You know, I know if I'm saying something because I really want to get people, you know, kind of stir the pot and get people on edge with each other, that's not promoting harmony. And I can have in my head that, you know, well, it's really the best thing to do here. But there's always an edge. And I think if I stay in touch with myself, I can feel what my intentions are. And it doesn't so much have to do with assumptions as what really my intentions are here. Am I saying this out of kindness, or am I saying this for the person's own good?
Uh-huh.
You know? That's not kindness. And I can, you know, there's a real... I mean, I really think I can tell the difference if I pay attention to the words.
Yeah, I think so. And that's why I think someone who does a mindfulness practice and is getting sensitive to their inner life would be very sensitive to right speech, I think. Because they know what their intentions are. Yeah.
I've noticed lately that I have more of a tendency when I'm uncomfortable about how to say something that feels difficult to me. I have more of a tendency to withhold something rather than to speak a lie or to speak hurtfully. And I was just thinking about an incident that feels incomplete for me. And I think that's what I get left with when I'm not either speaking ethically or I'm withholding myself. I get left with these incompletions.
Uh-huh.
People, you know, who kind of feel killed off in my life. And the example that I was thinking of is this fellow who was the husband of a friend of mine that died a couple of years ago, and I was very close to her, and after her death we spent a little bit of time together, not a lot. There was some discomfort between the two of us because this is kind of sexual stuff that was happening on his part that I found kind of icky. And I didn't really know what to do about it. I didn't want to confront it and push through it because I didn't know how to say it non-hurtfully. And yet what ended up happening is I lost the connection to him or any relationship that I would have because I didn't say anything. And I guess why I'm bringing it up is that I don't know how it is you say something to someone who
calls and wants to get together, and there's this incompletion that you need to speak about. And I don't really want to spend the energy working through it with them to come to the other side to have a friendship or whatever would be there.
Why not?
No, I'm not interested. And it's painful for me because in some respects I think it might actually be useful to say to him how I was affected by the things that he had said. And on the other hand, I really want to look at my motivation. I don't want to hurt him, and I don't want to exaggerate or blow something out of proportion. But it's such a dilemma, and I've been left with this kind of withheld feeling as though it's like a torn piece of fabric
Well, I'm struck that listening to you, I'm struck that these four criteria that the Buddha gave, the one to be kind, he doesn't. It actually just says, "Is it kind?" There's no direction to the kindness, and we kind of assuming it meant you're kind to the person you're speaking to, but it's also, is it kind for yourself to do it? What's appropriate for you? And sometimes what's needed is just you being honest. Sometimes it's not possible to complete or heal a relationship, but at least you can be complete in stating your piece of it. So in that situation, you might say, you know, I feel there's a sexual things going on between us. This is making it difficult for me to be with you, and I don't want to spend the energy working through that. See, we've talked and talked and talked so we'll end with a few minutes sitting. And I think it's very rich to talk about speech. You all. when a man whose marriage was in trouble sought her advice, the teacher said, "You must learn to listen to your wife." The man took this advice to heart and returned after a month to say he had learned to listen to every word his wife was saying. Said the teacher with a smile, "Now go home and listen to every word she isn't saying." Thank you for the conversation today. I'll see you in a couple of weeks.